Hello, this is Wendy Bauer, reading to you today from the Decatur Herald and Review, dated January 16th, 2017. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, "To Everything, Turn, Turn, Turn." This is a Shelbyville craftsman turning wood into art. Article written by Tony Reed, a Herald and Review staff writer from Shelbyville. Michelangelo, the Renaissance genius who gave us the David statue, said his technique was basically to cut away all the stone that wasn't David, and then he was done. Fast forward 500 years to rural Shelbyville, and we find wood-turning craftsman Jeremy Williams adopting a similar approach. His medium is dead wood rather than stone, and that wood is often twisted, holed, and decorated by the ravages of disease into artsy shapes and patterning. Chucking up a chunk of this on a huge lathe in a chilly workshop veneered in layers of sedimentary sawdust, he gets to work. "I remove material until I have my desired size and shape," explains Williams, 31. "With most kinds of woodworking, you take pieces and put them together to build something. With me, it's the opposite. Instead of putting parts together, I make shavings until I'm done." And while Michelangelo freed statues from the embrace of stone, Williams liberates a parade of exquisite wood bowls, vases, wooden bodies for ink pens, and even wine bottle stoppers. He has been known to fashion chess sets when the mood moves him and is open to doing commission work. He says customers bring out their deceased wood from favored felled trees and call upon him to transmute it into utilitarian art. Otherwise, our craftsman prowls wood dumps looking for the dead and diseased raw material the rest of us don't want. Under his loving hands, it becomes objet d'art that command prices ranging from $5 to about $400. He makes some very nice utilitarian pieces, and a particular interest of mine are his ink pens. He uses so many different woods, and they are of very high quality, says Carol Kessler, the owner of the not-for-profit Flourishes Gallery and Studios in Shelbyville. She first encountered Williams and his work at the farmer's market and quickly decided he deserved a more discerning audience. "I am a co-director for the Shelby County Arts Show, and we invited him to demonstrate an exhibit at our shows," Kessler adds. "He's done that and won major awards." Williams discovered a career in wood 7 years ago. His father, Stephen, was a carpenter who could build houses, but later laid aside his saw to become a pastor and run a church, mirroring the life that earlier carpenter who switched careers to found Christianity. "I was 10 when Dad stopped working with wood, and so, no, I didn't really learn wood turning at my father's knee," recalls Williams. He was, in fact, homesick one day from his job working at Walmart when he fired up the TV and found himself fascinated by a PBS guy turning a wood bowl. Everything grew from that, and now his art, supported by other odd jobs, including furniture repair, is how he makes his living. "I watched quite a few YouTube videos to figure out how to do what I wanted to do, and then it was lots of trial and error," he says. "I've had tools go flying out the window when something broke, but you have to be persistent to learn and find something you are passionate about. We all have to find that thing in life, that thing that we are willing to fail at so that later we can succeed." For more information, you can reach Jeremy Williams at 217-663-1943. And photographs accompany this article, the first with Jeremy Williams of Shelbyville making a bowl with a lathe while demonstrating wood turning, then three pepper grinders, beautifully dyed laminate veneer pepper grinders, and then Jeremy showing off a number of wood bowls. He's developed the skill of wood turning over the past 7 years. And these items will be buffed before they are finished. Those look like raw wood bowls, but spectacular looking wood grain in his finished products. And from the local page, former Sheriff Holzapfel dies on Sunday from Decatur. Former Macon County Sheriff H. Lee Holzapfel died Sunday. The Macon resident, 80, passed away at 11:35 a.m. in St. Mary's Hospital from natural causes, according to the Macon County Sheriff's Office. Arrangements are incomplete at Brintlinger and Earl Funeral Homes in Decatur. Holzapfel served 3 terms as sheriff from 1986 until 1999. He later sought a seat in the Illinois Senate as a Democrat. Sheriff Tom Schneider said Holzapfel was influential in the beginning of his law enforcement career, hiring him to work in the jail in 1988. He worked his way up through the ranks in the sheriff's office, serving as a sergeant and captain before winning his first election. "It is a sad day," Schneider said. "He was one of the finest leaders to work for. He wasn't a manager, he was a leader, a highly intelligent man with high integrity. Sheriff Holzapfel understood how to work with people to utilize resources to benefit the public he served." When Schneider worked a 3-year stint as a detective in the 1990s, Holzapfel actively took part in many of the cases. In the process, he passed on his knowledge to assist the younger law enforcement officers. The former sheriff was so dedicated to his profession that in 2009, when a murder suspect was arrested for the 1968 shooting death of a gas station worker in Blue Mound, he stepped forward to assist with the investigation. "He was instrumental in helping us get a conviction in that case," Schneider recalled. "He had reports that he kept on the case that were crucial to us. He was able to bring it together to work with the detectives to give us the insight on what it was back then." Partly as a result of the former sheriff's effort, a 42-year-old cold case was solved, and the 66-year-old killer was sentenced to 14 to 25 years in prison. Holzapfel, a U.S. Navy veteran, was active in the American Legion. "He was a strong man up until his passing," Schneider said, adding that he kept in touch with him throughout his retirement years. Also from the local page, education column, written by Valerie Wells, Herald and Review staff writer. Dennis students learn to budget travel. This is from Decatur. Any family trip requires serious planning, especially on a limited budget, to make sure it goes smoothly. Students in fourth grade at Dennis School are getting a trial run and doing just that with their latest project. Sue Phillips, one of the teachers behind the assignment, invited Diana Ritter of Village Travel to talk to the students about the costs of making trips. The students each chose a state and were assigned to research that state and create a plan to visit 8 states. One must be a national park, or if the state doesn't boast a national park, a state park. California is so vast, so Ritter chose the San Francisco area to concentrate on, because there are many things to see nearby, from the giant redwoods to Alcatraz Island. Fresno, a short drive from San Francisco, is home to 2 national parks, Sequoia and Kings Canyon. "I'm not a bridge person," Ritter said with a chuckle. "I've driven to the Golden Gate Bridge and looked at it, but I can't drive across it." Travel agents call adjustments for clients' fears or physical limitations qualifying the client. If someone is afraid of flying or bridges, the agent plans a trip that avoids those things. Phillips had told the students they should plan to work within a budget of $2,000, so the kids' reaction to Ritter's final tally of $3,687, which included hotels admission to national parks, renting a car, plane tickets, but not food, was astonishment and some laughter. "No food," said Zoe Creighton. "That's going to be a problem." Her choice of state is Oklahoma, and her parents have been so impressed with her research so far that they're planning a real trip to the state to take advantage of Zoe's hard work. Daniel Muth chose Pennsylvania because he was born there, but his parents moved when he was a toddler and he doesn't remember it. Hayden Watson chose California. "I'd like to live there someday," she said. "They have Disneyland and it's warm." Brielle Jackson's state is New York, home of the Statue of Liberty, which she wants to see. While it took Ritter only a short time to plan an itinerary and calculate prices and overall cost, she warned the kids that they should figure on quite a bit more time than that for their own projects. She has a ready list of airlines and hotels at hand, and it's her profession, while they'll have to figure out things as they go. However, with the internet and handy sites like the National Park Service, plus tricks such as knowing to check with the city's Chamber of Commerce, the process should go smoothly, she said. Students will present their final projects at the school's Problem-Based Learning Assembly in February. And the photograph that accompanies this article shows teacher Sue Phillips pointing to photos of some of the possible destinations in California while travel agent Diana Ritter of Village Travel talks to students about planning an itinerary. The students are embarking on a new project to learn about budgeting a family trip. And the photograph shows a whole classroom of children showing rapt attention to the project. The next article, also from the local page, is written by Chris Luzvardi, Herald and Review staff writer. Technology column, Comcast expanding business services in Decatur. Comcast Business is expanding the advanced network offered in Decatur, including additional fiber optic cable. The expansion is intended to give wider access to high internet speeds as part of efforts to retain and attract businesses in the city. The expansion passes several locations, ranging from the Decatur Civic Center to Richland Community College and the Archer Daniels Midland Intermodal Rail Facility that is part of the Midwest Inland Port. "These investments are another way Comcast continues to fuel Decatur's economy," said John Crowley, Comcast's regional senior vice president. "We intend to keep bringing the best technologies and services here." It adds to the city's focus on efforts to expand access to fiber. "The continued addition of fiber in Decatur will help businesses here compete and grow and will help us attract new ones whose business models depend on advanced internet and telecommunications technologies," said Patrick Hoban, the city's economic development officer. Comcast, which has been doing business in Decatur since 2008, will provide internet speeds of up to 100 Gbps, or billions of bits per second, along with services including Ethernet internet, voice, and value-added cloud services. "In today's economy, having an environment with easy access to high-speed broadband represents a critical tool for community development and for improving the quality of life for both current and future residents, which is an important goal for all of us," Hoban said. Comcast has 750 miles of network, including 100 miles of fiber in Decatur. It has established 12,000 Xfinity Wi-Fi hotspots to connect residents and visitors to content on the go. "Providing increased bandwidth means customers can do more with technology resources, including accessing more applications and services in the cloud," said Jay Dirkmott, Regional Vice President of Comcast Business. Dirkmott said other uses include linking multiple branches, accommodating the rapidly increasing numbers of employees in the field using mobile devices, and exchanging large amounts of data. In addition to business services, Decatur was one of the first cities in the country where Comcast offered new residential internet service delivering 1 Gbps speeds over its existing lines. Millikan University is the first university in central Illinois to make Xfinity on campus available, providing a service that allows college students to watch live television and on-demand content on laptops, tablets, and smartphones. And from the At Work page, Work-Life Balance Strengthens Worker Retention, written by Catherine Roberts, a Tribune News Service writer. More and more employers are making a business case for family-friendly workplace policies. Several top-performing companies already offer 6 weeks or more of paid leave as they try to retain parents. Led by technology and financial companies jockeying for talent, many have a more flexible workplace and more help with finding childcare than a decade ago. The issue is getting renewed attention, thanks perhaps to advocacy from President-elect Donald Trump's daughter, Ivanka. Now many firms are going even further, all in an attempt to make 30 and 40-somethings happy. For example, starting January 1st, 3M changed its policy from 12 weeks unpaid leave to a total of 20 weeks, with 10 weeks of paid and 10 weeks of unpaid leave for both birth and adopting parents. It's not a surprise that companies are changing policies to retain and recruit employees who are starting families. Many of these employees are moving up the ranks, and it costs 1.5 to 2 times their salaries to replace senior leaders and 70% of their salaries for team members, according to Workplace Dynamics, a Pennsylvania company that surveys companies about employee satisfaction and produces top workplaces lists in 45 markets. The national accounting firm KPMG already had paid parental leave and flexible work policies on the books. But a few years ago, human resources managers started hearing how employees with families, especially new parents, were feeling out of sorts trying to balance the needs of their households with the desire to succeed at work. We heard that the transition to parenthood is difficult. If we can help with that and ultimately retain the individual and help them re-engage in their career while feeling still successful in this new aspect of their life, parenthood, then it's a win-win for everyone, said Barbara Wankoff, KPMG's Executive Director of Diversity and Inclusion. As a result, the firm in 2014 added new parent coaching. So far, 200 people have taken advantage of the service, and Deanne Watchmaker, Associate Director of Human Relations for the Minneapolis office. Employees can sign up for coaching sessions before a child is born, during leave to set up a transition back to work, and then afterward to help troubleshoot issues both at work and home. Allison Tyra, a human resources manager in Minneapolis, said the coaching helped her tremendously. The phone call before she had her child helped her set priorities on setting up her clients so she could truly step away and give myself permission to stop checking email. The coach also gave Tyra reality checks on what her expectations should be. Before she came back from her 4 months off, which was a combination of disability and 12 weeks of paid maternity leave, they talked about how to dive back in, including logistics of getting up to speed and how to re-engage with clients. The coach also brought up topics to make sure Tyra was ready, such as making sure childcare plans were set, but also if she had tried on her work clothes to make sure they fit, and worked out the drop-off schedule and home chore responsibilities with her husband. It was certainly, I thought, very helpful, Tyra said. And further from the At Work page, Opinion, written by Andrea Seelak for Tribune News Service. Etiquette, should you say that you may go? Question, should you tell coworkers that you plan to leave your job? Is it different if you don't have anything lined up versus having scored a job interview with another company? Answer, as with most relationships in the office and in life, it all boils down to trust. Is your coworker a colleague who has your back? Your gut feeling can speak volumes. If you have any doubts, you're better off not sharing your plan. Even if you've scored a job interview with another company, that's not the same as formally accepting a solid job offer. To be on the safe side, that's the point at which you should share the news, but only after you've given notice to your boss. Word can spread inadvertently, even among well-meaning colleagues. Letting your coworkers know about a successful job interview can jeopardize your current position, references, and even your reputation if you're not careful. Keep in mind that even after you've received a formal offer, the negotiation process can break down, and then you may be in a lose-lose situation if you've broadcast your impending departure prematurely. That was from Lynn Taylor, human resources expert, speaker, and author. Another answer. It's never a good idea to tell your coworkers. Many of them will likely assume you're not going to do your fair share if you've already got one foot out the door. It's best to keep that information to yourself until you've put in your notice. For example, if the boss approaches your coworker to talk about a project he wants the two of you to work on together, your coworker may be in a tough spot since there's a good chance you won't be employed long enough to see the project through. And if you are in a rare situation where it would be acceptable to tell your boss you're looking for a new job, tell him or her first. Besides, you never know what might happen. You might struggle to land a new job, or you might find that other organizations can't offer you enough money or perks to justify leaving. And that opinion was written by Amy Morin, psychotherapist, speaker, and author of 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. And another Q&A from the At Work page. From your office coach, talking clears up confusion. Question. I'm not sure what to do about someone stealing my ideas. During a recent business school project, I was teamed with another classmate who seemed to like my approach to the assignment. Michael generally followed my lead and seldom made suggestions of his own. After a while, I noticed that another team's presentations were sounding very similar to ours. When I overheard Michael talking with them, I realized that he had been giving away my ideas. Although this felt like a betrayal, I decided not to confront him about it. Instead, I sent the other team an email complimenting them on their progress and suggesting that we get together to compare projects. Now, I'm not sure if this was the right thing to do. How should I have handled this situation? Answer. Your current dilemma provides a textbook example of the problems created by unclear expectations. At the beginning of this assignment, you and Michael should have asked your professor whether teams were allowed to exchange information. If so, then the two of you could have agreed on what was appropriate to share. As it was, Michael simply followed his natural inclination to collaborate, which seemed to you like a violation of trust. Even though you felt strongly about this, as indicated by the words stealing and betrayal, you elected not to discuss it. Instead, you invited the other team to a meeting without asking Michael's opinion, and thereby treating him just as he had treated you. To avoid replicating this muddle in the business world, make a habit of always clarifying expectations with your manager and your colleagues. And instead of bottling up resentments, learn how to resolve your concerns in a calm, professional manner. And finally, from the Q&A column, question. For several years, I have been the maintenance supervisor for a ski lift company. Our new general manager says my employees are not performing properly and that I'm not doing enough to motivate them. In his view, motivation means threatening disciplinary action. The only problem with my crew is that management has never provided any training on ski lift maintenance, so they don't have the required skills. Now my boss is implying that if my employees' performance doesn't improve, my own job might be at risk. What can I do about this? Answer. Your manager needs to learn the difference between a skill problem and an attitude problem. Here's the standard question for differentiating the two. Could the employee do this task correctly if their life depended on it? If the answer is no, then there is clearly a skill deficit, and neither carrots nor sticks will have any effect. Of course, the real problem may be that your boss doesn't know what ski lift maintenance requires, as managers often lack knowledge about the jobs they oversee. In that case, give him a list of the necessary abilities, highlight areas where your crew needs improvement, and provide information about available training programs. A quick internet search for ski lift maintenance training will indicate which schools offer this instruction and why it's so important for both your customers and your company. And from Des Moines, Iowa, Iowa pushes to defund Planned Parenthood. Iowa's governor has proposed cutting funding for needy kids as part of his plan to defund Planned Parenthood, a rare step even as Republican-dominated states grapple with whether to sacrifice federal dollars in order to lessen the organization's influence. According to budget projections reviewed by the Associated Press, Governor Terry Branstad has recommended taking $2.8 million previously given to Child and Family Services so it can be redirected to create a roughly $3.3 million program that distributes family planning money to organizations that do not perform abortions. None of Iowa's family planning money is used to fund abortions, and the state's funding for Planned Parenthood goes to other women's health services, such as birth control counseling and health exams. Iowa receives more than $3 million in federal Medicaid funding that it must spend on family planning services, and some of that is tied to Planned Parenthood. Branstad, who is expected to resign soon from his Iowa job to become President-elect Donald Trump's ambassador to China, told legislators in an address last week that he supports removing state funding for Planned Parenthood to redirect it to other groups. His office later confirmed to the AP that the governor backed the creation of a state-run program that would pass up millions of federal Medicaid dollars for family planning services. Branstad's office said it would pay for the state-run program by tapping into the Social Services Block Grant, a separate pot of federal money that provides aid to vulnerable children, adults, and families. Ben Hams, a spokesman for Branstad, originally insisted that services provided by this roughly $15 million fund would not be affected. He backtracked after reviewing documents provided by AP. Amy McCoy, spokeswoman for the Iowa Department of Human Services, said core services such as foster care wouldn't be affected by Branstad's proposed cut, which would take effect for the budget year beginning in July. But she confirmed that the governor's plan would mean less funding for preventative programs that reduce the chance of children entering welfare and the juvenile justice system. In the end, Branstad's overall budget for Child and Family Services for the next budget year, which will be about $127 million, will be $2 million less than what's estimated for this current budget. The governor has also asked state agencies to cut about $110 million from the current $7.2 billion to plug a shortfall of available cash. Rachel Lopez, a spokeswoman for Planned Parenthood of the Heartland, the Iowa affiliate of the national organization, criticized Republicans, including Branstad and Lieutenant Governor Kim Reynolds, who will succeed him. And we will take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, January 16th, 2017. Please stay tuned.